Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, it's February 11th, 2018, coming up on Valentine's Day. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, good to know.
Are you ready?
No.
Okay.
To be honest.
All right, well, you got time. You got a couple of days. So we went to Encores this week. Encores, of course, being the series of three performances each year at City Center, and at which there are weekend concerts of musicals, which are generally not quite at the level that you would expect full revivals, but worth seeing over the weekend. And they did something a little different this time. They did a review of several shows with the title Hey, Look Me Over. And these are these were shows from which are even a cut below what they would normally think of as encore weekend productions, and for that reason, they just want to take excerpts from them. So they had excerpts from six or seven musicals.
Right. And, what'd you think?
I liked it, but you know, it was for devotees of the musical theater. You had to be inclined to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And there were some numbers that landed and some that didn't land.
You had to have a willing suspension of disbelief.
Very willing. Yeah. Very willing.
All kind of an inside group kind of rooting for this whole thing.
Yes, and that's a good point because Encores has that going for it. And that was palpable here. They had a fellow named Bob Martin who was kind of did a jokey MC act. And he was sort of playing the incredibly fussy Encores type fan with very strong views about all these obscure musicals. And you get the
based
feeling,
on the man in the chair.
That's a character he created
for the Drowsy Chaperone.
That's right. And that theater-going crowd, as soon as they saw this fellow Bob Martin, they knew he was the character in the Drowsy Chaperone.
We didn't know.
But there.
But we knew he was funny. He was amusing.
He was funny, and he's from Canadian television. He's SCTV. And more the point, though, the crowd is so into Broadway theater, every little inside joke, every half reference, they're eating it up. And you really get a feeling that you're in a sort of a community there, that group is just totally loving this, and they're just glad to be with a group that's so interested in musical theater. So they had, you know, some ups and downs.
What were the musicals?
Well, they drew from these shows. I'll just, without comment. The shows are mostly from the 60s. Wildcat, All American, Jamaica, Milk and Honey, Mac and Mabel, Green Willow, Sail Away. And they play the overture from Subway's Art for Sleeping. And if you're...
Well, there's also George M.
And George M, that's right, at the very end. And if you're saying to yourself, yeah, I'm not sure I know those musicals.
I only had ever heard of Mac and Mabel and George M.
And yeah, that's about right. The Mac and Mabel being the best known and the one that really came off best in their performances there. And George M. being about George M. Cohan.
Whose performances did you like?
Whose performance? Well, I think the standout, and the reviews sort of bore this out, at least they agreed, was Mac and Mabel. Mac and Mabel is the best show of all the ones that they were excerpting from. And that's the story of Max Sennett, who was a silent movie producer, and Mabel Normand, who was one of his big stars, and it was initially played by Robert Preston and Bernadette Peters. And here you had Douglas Sills and a woman named Alexandra Socha, not as well known. But
did you mention this was Jerry Herman?
No, I didn't. It's a Jerry Herman musical. And it was, it's known as a pretty good musical. They did two very compelling numbers. They really sold them, and I think those were clearly the standouts for me. What do you think was best?
Yeah, no, I like them. I especially liked Alexandra Socha. Mm-hmm. I didn't even think her song was very good, but she was terrific. Mm-hmm. She's young, full of charisma,
right.
Very engaging. Also in it, we saw the gal who played Babe in Pajama Game, that production that Sadie and I saw at Arena Stage, and that's Brittany Coleman.
Right.
And she was in a couple of different numbers.
Right.
So it was good to see her again.
Right.
And then there was this a young guy, Clifton Duncan.
Who had a great voice.
Who had a great voice. And that was, he did a song from Green Willow.
Which was awful.
And every other song was awful. Even the song he did was not that great, but he was great.
Yeah.
And you just feel you had to, They were making you sit through the rest of the Green Willow to get to this glorious voice.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because the review in the Times said that it's an excerpt. It was pretty consistent with what you and I are saying. And it said the best musicals are solid state, everywhere dense with their core ideas. Lesser shows may produce a song or two that can kill in the cabaret, but they fall apart when sliced into wedges. And I think that was fair.
You mean this was falling apart?
Not falling apart, but, you know, unless you had an audience like this, this was not a commercial thing. This is, you know, you get devotees in musical theater, they enjoy this. But you couldn't make this run for any length of time. I don't think people would see
it. But other fun people who were in it, Vanessa Williams.
Although the Herbs didn't land so great.
All right, you don't have to be a hater. B.B. Newworth, Herbs didn't land
so great. No. So B.B. Newworth, I thought did a little better. But the interesting thing about B.B. Newworth is that she did that song from the Noel Coward musical, Sail Away. And the song was, Why, oh, why do the wrong people travel and the right people stay at home? And that's a pretty funny title, and the song isn't much funnier than that.
It was a little snarky.
A little snarky.
A little mean about it.
But she sold it, and she's B.B. Newworth, and God knows they love B.B. Newworth at Encores because she's the one who helped create Chicago, and Chicago funds that whole city center's effort. So that's considered a great thing.
So anyway, so it was fun. There were other people, Judy Kuhn, and what's his name, Mark Kudish?
Oh, sure. Carolee Carmello was in it.
So there.
Now they had some real names in it, and you know, it's funny. I was looking at the program, and we talk about, or at least I think about, how, you know, what works and what doesn't work here, and you know, the musical theater is a little wacky to begin with, right? You said at the beginning, it's willing suspension of disbelief, and they have this great quote that appears in the program, which kind of sums up Encores for me. And here's the quote: "There are shortcuts to happiness. And dancing is one of them." And that's like, you know, forget the reality. Just go right to the singing and dancing. And that's a quote from a woman named Vicky Baum, who wrote the novel Grand Hotel. Mm-hmm. And Grand Hotel is their next production. And that's March 21 to March 25th. And I bet that's going to be great.
That should be fun.
Yeah, so get your tickets to the Grand Hotel. And then we saw a movie last night. I took you to the movies, right? You remember that.
Yes.
We saw The Phantom Thread.
We saw it at the Vintage Movie Theater in Doylestown.
Right.
Which is a charming theater.
Right.
And it was a good crowd at the 3:45 show.
Right.
And what did the crowd think?
Crowd didn't love it. That was my read on it. The crowd is, you know, it's an...
The ladies behind me just all stood up and said, well, that was weird. Mm.
Yeah, it was not that they didn't love it, but what did you think of it?
I thought there wasn't much to it. Right. I was shocked, too. Now, it's...
we should set the stage.
It's made by Paul Thomas Anderson.
Right.
Okay, so he's done weirdish stuff, Boogie Nights.
Right, it's very distinguished stuff, you know.
Yeah.
He's done films with Daniel Day-Lewis, and this, of course... There Will Be Blood, which was a great movie, and so... Daniel Day-Lewis here plays a designer of clothes, really. But he's a master designer with a large following. And it's ladies' fashion. It's ladies' high fashion dresses. And he's designing and tailoring the clothes and having fittings and having a group of 15 or 20 people working for him, seamstresses, working on the dresses. And he's sort of on the fringes of English society, I think it's fair enough to say. And he is in a very impressive figure. Obviously, he is
a man with a lot of issues. Is what he is.
Well, on the surface, he's
what
a master.
On the surface,
he's a master of industry. He's he's first of all, he's impeccably turned out, as one would expect someone to be in the fashion industry. He's meticulous in his speech and his appearance. He seems highly intelligent, and he's a craftsman besides. And his dresses seem entirely successful and worthy of the attention that they get. He has all that going for him. But as the movie goes on, you realize all is not well.
And yeah, he's a nutcase.
That
wasn't a surprise.
Daniel
Day-Lewis is playing a character, you know there are going
to
be multiple layers.
Really? Is that the way you were seeing it?
Yes. Nothing is straightforward with Daniel Day-Lewis characters.
Okay, well, that's an interesting. Look, I like Daniel Day-Lewis. And I think there are some people who don't, strangely.
So who else was in it? Young woman, his love interest.
Yeah, what's her name?
Was Vicky, I don't know how to pronounce it. Krebs.
Krebs, yes.
And his sister was played by Leslie Manville.
And you can tell me something
about
Leslie
Manville. I loved her.
Really?
I loved her. And it turns out she is Mrs. Gary Oldman.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, that would take a person of substance.
So we have some real,
Well, that's interesting because Gary Oldman,
film royalty.
The competition for best actor is between Gary Oldman and Daniel Day-Lewis. So she'll be torn, but maybe not so torn. And actually, I don't think it's much of a competition. I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis was interesting. The movie was a couple bricks short of a load, which was a little surprising to me because on its surface is a wonderful sheen, and there were certain scenes in it. They were just almost like photographs. There were moments that you would say, that's a fabulous shot.
The sets were beautiful.
It was beautiful.
The clothing of the period was beautiful.
Right. But there was
the acting was beautiful.
Right. And there were just some plot points, some character development points. And I'm perfectly happy to see a movie that's just a character study. And that's what I thought it was going to be, but there was... It deviated from that. It went into a certain kind of plot, a certain kind of story, and the story didn't land.
So, it veered around in some areas of darkness.
It was odd. So it's not...
But afterwards, we went out for a great dinner.
We did.
I should say. And we went to a restaurant in Doylestown, PA.
Right.
Called, I'm not sure how to say this either, Slate Bleu.
You're asking the wrong guy.
It's a little bistro
right.
sort of place. It was just kind of fun because we walked in out of the pouring rain and they had no room for us.
Yeah.
And a lady at the bar scooched over and made room for our group of four.
Right.
And, you know, everybody was so nice.
Right.
It was different from being in... New York, I thought.
Oh, people are nice in New York sometimes.
But anyway, a little shout out to Lori McGahey, who moved over for us. And she's the senior director of advancement at the Michener Museum.
Which is nearby.
Yeah, the James Michener Museum, a terrific museum in Doylestown. Mm-hmm. And with a great exhibition going on right now that has Andrew Wyeth's sister, Henrietta Wyeth. And paintings by her and her husband, Peter Hurd.
Really?
And Peter Hurd actually studied with her father, which would be N.C. Wyeth. Anyway, it's pretty interesting. Lori was a lovely companion at the bar. And we encourage everybody to go to Slate Bleu.
And your husband, too,
for some
lovely companion.
Right. Terrific yes. French bistro-esque.
It was quite good. It was quite nice.
Food and go to the Michener.
Yes. So, speaking of fantastic dates... with your husband. Valentine's Day, as you mentioned, the outset is coming up, and you had a couple of stories that sort of fold into Valentine's Day.
Yeah, well, Valentine's Day always involves chocolate. And so we've read a million articles about chocolate, haven't we? And all the benefits. Mm-hmm. And it's good for your heart, it's good for this, it's good for that. And it's got to be dark chocolate, etc. And so there's a little article about the history of chocolate and how it really took the Spaniards a long time to warm up to chocolate, actually, as they drank it in Mexico. They had with a little bit of spice in it, etc., no sugar. Mm-hmm. And so eventually the Europeans figured out to add some sugar.
Genius.
And one of the great stories... Yeah. Out of this history of chocolate is the finding of a book, Voyages to Jamaica, written in 1725 by Sir Hans Sloane, who really is not a fan of the chocolate drink. He suggests adding milk. Mm. Now, Sloane is actually the physician who founded the British Museum.
Okay.
But anyway, he ends up selling this... his recipe for this concoction of milk and this weird chocolate to Cadbury.
Oh, there you go.
And the rest is
There's an article in the Journal today about the unrecognized virtues of milk chocolate. That people put it down as unsophisticated.
Yeah, I think that's silly. I think milk chocolate can be quite delicious.
But you're a dark chocolate girl.
I love dark chocolate, but I have come back to milk chocolate
as
well.
Oh, you didn't tell me.
Yeah, because there's a kind of a silky, wonderful experience that happens when you eat the milk chocolate. Sadie's a big milk chocolate
fan. This information is coming in too late for Valentine's
Day. But I also like dark chocolate. And of course, it's, let's face it, if you're, I'm sad to say, if you're eating Hershey's chocolate, you're generally getting like not even 11% of chocolate in your chocolate bar. Mm-hmm. So there's not much healthful impact there. So I do find, in that sense, dark chocolate, a percentage of 72 or higher, much tastier. But I'm also a fan of a good quality, a fine quality concoction of
milk
chocolate.
That's good for me to know. Thanks for letting me know.
Okay, and also I've seen a lot of articles in the past week or so about the heart as an icon, and the two-lobed little thing that we think of as the heart, which doesn't really look at all like a human heart, and how that came about and so on. And in the Wall Street Journal today, there's the review of a book called The Amorous Heart by Marilyn Yalom, and who really kind of researches the heart and how it has served, how it became the universal metaphor for our emotions. I mean, we don't even think about it, but it's not totally obvious that that's the organ you would choose as controlling, being in charge of the emotions. So it's a fun and interesting little book, and goes into such terrific details, such as between the 13th and 17th century, it was not unusual for French kings to be buried in two separate sites. Okay? To be precise, the body would be at Saint-Denis, and the heart, their heart would be buried elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Also popes. There is a particular church in Rome, Santa Vincenzo and Anastasio a Trevi, that has 22 papal hearts in it.
So this is a little, buried in it. A little gross there, but yes.
I don't know. It's weird. You know, I remember seeing the poet Shelley's heart is buried in the Protestant cemetery. Yeah. My favorite cemetery.
Where is the rest of him?
You know, now you're testing me. All I remember is seeing the thing that said in Latin, Shelley's heart is here.
Well, I'm glad they straightened that out. So now they don't do it that way anymore.
And just in case you want to know, the first use of that two-lobed heart icon thing.
The familiar heart
seems
shape.
To have been in 1344. They have a illustrated manuscript by Jean de Gris, detailing the romance of Alexander.
All right. Well, that's useful. It's also useful is that the Times did an article about the movies you might consider watching for Valentine's Day because they're the most romantic. I will tell you my own view in terms of the movies that this movie that's in movie theaters right now that is strangely the most appropriate for Valentine's Day, I would think, is The Shape of Water. I don't know if you agree, but I found that a pretty romantic movie.
Extremely romantic. I mean, very, very touching, very poignant, and very beautiful. Romantic in every sense of the word. Really a delight to watch with love in mind.
Well, I'm glad. That's the way I felt about it. There was an article this week. They run a general column in the Times called The Carpetbagger about the awards season. They're building up to the Oscars. They do it every year. And this was by a woman named Kara Buckley. And her theme was, it's surprising that The Shape of Water is garnering so much attention and support because it doesn't seem in tune with political movements, the Me Too movement, all that kind of stuff. And so she did a series of interviews, and she got reactions from critics and the like. Here's one. It just says it's layered and intelligent and accessible, but mainstream. It's just magical. This fellow named Michael Schamburg, a producer, says that, look, it's well-designed, well-shot, well-costumed, and it moves you. It says something very emotional about human connection and love using the vocabulary of genre, and that's why people respond. I think that's all true. So in any event, I do think, in my mind, the most romantic movie around. But the Times also had another article about streaming services, streaming older movies. And interestingly,
so if you're at home and you want to watch a romantic movie, Valentine's movie.
Right. And one of the first ones they mentioned is a movie that we hadn't thought of right away, but we think is a great movie. And that's a movie called I Know Where I'm Going.
Right. Made in 1945 by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. Starring Wendy Hiller and Roger Livesey.
Right.
And we saw it about 500 years ago. Not in 1945.
Give or take a few years.
Probably in 1975. I'm guessing.
But
on TV.
Yeah, the late show or something.
On a day like this, it was like a rainy,
right,
cold, bleak day. And it was shocking what a good movie it was. Black and white. We loved it.
And the strange thing about it, it's worth mentioning because no one knows this movie. Or no one in the U.S. knows this movie. It's an English movie. And it is, you know, quite apart from romantic and whatever, it is a great film. I mean, you know, it would be nice if The Phantom Thread lived up to that level.
So that's I Know Where I'm Going.
Yeah.
In 1945, Wendy Hiller. What else were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, in terms of the services, The Times makes the point of saying that Filmstruck and its attendant Criterion Channel have it. I don't know if many people get that, and I don't know if there's not another way to get
it. But find it. And the most fun, and I remember this so clearly, watching the film and then looking at the credits afterwards.
Right.
We're really looking at the credits because we just love this movie.
Yeah, it's a stunning
film. And we're you know, fascinated by it. And we notice near the end, do you notice who, do you remember who was in the movie that really surprised us?
I don't remember who.
Petula Clark.
Oh, really? I don't remember.
Yes, 1945. She was a child actress.
Oh, my God. I forgot that.
And, you know, so we're thinking of, and that was, you know, her songs were a little bit, we had been in, you know, in like high school or elementary school, middle school.
Downtown.
Downtown. Yeah. I Know a Place.
Yeah.
Don't Sleep in the Subway, Baby.
Yeah. Okay.
And all that. But she was a child actress in that. So.
Yeah, I Know Where I'm Going. If you get a chance, find it. Yeah, you found an interesting article about the origins of Shakespeare. People keep coming back to this.
Well, it's not about Shakespeare so much as, well, it is about Shakespeare. Yeah. But it's really kind of fun because the title of the article was Plagiarism Software Unveils a New Source for 11 of Shakespeare's Plays. So that's just kind of fun because, of course, all teachers like myself use plagiarism software. We can turn on software that while we're reading, it will read a paper that a student has written and isolate similarities from that paper with other, you know, known writings, works somewhere in the great Ethernet,
right?
And so this kind of interesting guy, Dennis McCarthy, basically he's a self-taught Shakespeare scholar, a computer nerd. He's just on the computer all the time and got into kind of researching miscellaneous stuff, came across some reference to an unpublished manuscript that he tracked down. He saw a little reference to it here. Then it turns out the British Museum has it. They bought it in 1933, but then it takes a while for them to even find it. He finally finds it and is able to ascertain that there are strong similarities between language, you know, characters mentioned and language used in this book called A Brief Discourse of Rebellion and Rebels, written in the late 1500s by George North, a minor figure in the court of Queen Elizabeth. Okay, and one other scholar who has reviewed this information said, yeah, it looks like that work could be in the background mix of Shakespeare's mental landscape, which is kind of
a neat
way to put it, isn't it?
It's a little vague to me.
Anyway, yeah. McCarthy sends this information to June Schleuder, who is a retired professor from Lafayette and an editor of something called the Shakespeare Journal, and they put out a book about this. So this is kind of very exciting that research is still being done, can still be done. I guess what makes this especially interesting at this point is it's an unpublished manuscript. So you've been able to do these things for quite a few years, do this kind of research for quite a few years with published, but now we've got to delve deeper.
Oh, all right. That's interesting. I didn't think about that.
So that's kind of fun that plagiarism software is being used for something interesting as opposed to depressing.
Well, but that plagiarism software is something that we've read about even previously. That is interesting.
And then also, was I supposed to talk about something else?
Well, I don't know if that's...
Oh, yes, I was supposed to talk about something else.
Yes, what?
So this is kind of fun. You know, I did my master's thesis on a fellow named Hendrik Christian Andersen.
Right.
And the guy just follows me around.
Yeah.
He just follows. Well, he's been dead many, many years.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, he keeps cropping up. This week, there was an article about a mural that was from the studio of Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney.
Mm-hmm.
As in Whitney Museum.
I know.
Okay.
Yes.
As in she was a sculptress, a sculptor, we should call her. And this is her studio. Here's another great link.
Whitney family owned the Mets at one point.
Here's another great link out in Old Westbury, her studio. Your neck of the woods.
Yeah, exactly. So okay. A little bit for the upper class.
Anyway, there's a mural done by a fellow named Howard Gardner Cushing.
Right.
Brother-in-law?
Andersen.
Of Andersen,
yeah.
Exactly. Mm. Anyway, here's another great, the mural, the subject matter is of various women.
Yeah.
Courtesans, musicians, and others. He paints his wife, he paints Whitney, etc., all inspired by costumes and scenes from, you guessed it, Ballet Russe.
Oh my God.
And Whistler and Japanese Prince. These were done around 1911, right. So we're back with our guys, our other crazy geniuses.
Are we going to Long Island to see this? Is that what's happening?
It's been sold. It was 125 feet long.
Huge.
It's been cut up into panels. It was sold. Apparently, the family needed money for medical bills.
Oh, that's sad.
And so the Cushings, who are still around, they still have a mansion in Newport, as I've mentioned before, and they bought it for allegedly millions of dollars. It's in 18 pieces, and they had a photographic reproduction done that's in the studio in Old Westbury. Now you can go see it. And there's some pictures in the New York Times online. So I just, you know, a little shout out to Hendrik Christian Andersen. You know,
following us around. Right.
Possibly had a relationship with Henry James.
Otherwise, totally obscure.
You know, another one of those crazy geniuses from the 19-teens. The 19-teens.
All right, Super Bowl this week. We're not going to recap the Super Bowl. For those who
aren't
aware, the Eagles won. A game which I was convinced the Eagles were going to lose until, with 2 minutes to go, the Patriots fumbled. That game came down in some ways to two plays. It was a very good game. One, the play that much ballyhooed before the half, the Philly special, the crazy play where there was a double handoff and then a pass to the quarterback in the end zone. Two interesting things about that. Number one, as I think everyone's aware of, the play was called by the quarterback. He actually came over to the coach saying, let's use the Philly special. Well, to his credit, kind of amazing in the Super Bowl, with all those coaches getting paid to do nothing, apparently. And the second is, about that play, was it such a secret play that the Eagles didn't even dare practice the play in Minnesota the week of the game. They did it in the hotel room. They actually got into the hotel room
and
practiced.
Somebody had a big room.
Yeah. They must have had a suite. And they practiced in the hotel room, which is tough because you want to make sure nothing goes wrong. The other funny thing is the other big play was the play that turned out to be the winning touchdown. Was the play that you'll recall, Timson, that they looked at numerous times. The fellow catches the pass. He heads toward the end zone. He dives. He falls. The ball bounces in the air. Is it a completed pass? Is it a touchdown? What is it? And the ruling was a touchdown, and the Eagles won the game. But the interesting thing about that play, which no one seems to have noticed, is the receiver made a bad play. You don't want to score a touchdown on that play.
Mm.
Okay? Mm. He's diving, taking a chance to score a touchdown. You want to land on the one-yard line.
Okay.
Because if you land on 1 yard line, you run two or three plays, you run the clock out before you score and win
the
game.
Right, right.
So he's killing himself to do the wrong thing.
Right,
so
exactly.
That's totally weird. But what's more important...
In other words, that if they were on the 1 yard line, then they're running out the clock. If they have this touchdown, the other team has more time to try to
come back. Only reason the Eagles won was because they fumbled. They needed the fumble. But if he stops on the one, they don't even need the fumble. They just win the game.
Yeah.
And yet, no one seemed to have picked up on that.
It might have been caught up in the moment.
Yes. Well, fortunately, you and I don't fall to that.
So we enjoyed the commercials.
But
there were some good commercials. I like the Tide commercials. Did you like the Tide
commercials?
Oh, the Tide
commercials were clearly the best.
Yeah.
Clearly the best.
Yeah.
And I'm a big fan of Tide. They do a nice job of the laundry. But the dance team,
The dance team of
Eli Manning
and Odell Beckham,
of course, was the commercial that captured the New York fans. Then several articles. Matter of fact, the Post headline
That was great.
The Post headline the next day was Giants win Super Bowl, and then in small print underneath ads, because that got a lot of attention. And that was Beckham and Manning reenacting the dance scene from Dirty Dancing, in which at the end, Jennifer Grey in the movie leaps up in the air and is caught by Patrick Swayze, in this case, Beckham being caught by Manning. But they had an interview with the choreographer, a woman named Stephanie Clemens, and what she said, I guess in retrospect, there's no surprise, but here it is in black and white. Number one, she thought, wow, these two guys have exceptional set of physical and mental skills. Number one. Number two, Eli Manning, the way he was able to execute the moves on the beat, very impressive. That's not easy. Odell, she says he's fantastic. When the camera was on, it was 3-2-1 perfect. And on top of that, they were, quote, unbelievable partners, as they are on the field. So there you go. I think this portends a very big year for the Giants next season. We're looking forward to that.
If for some reason people didn't watch the Super Bowl and see it during the Super Bowl, do Google it and find that ad, because it is wonderful. They actually dance together. It's not just and the leap is pretty fantabulous.
Yeah,
the leap of Beckham.
And of course, Eli's reputation is kind of a goofball. It's kind of, doesn't move that well. He's not even that athletic, but he does enough to get by. And Odell is in a different sphere in terms of his athletic bona fides. So they're a funny couple. And the Olympics are starting up. And
we haven't watched that much.
No,
we saw some ice dancing.
We did.
Who doesn't love ice dancing?
No, nobody doesn't love ice dancing. I'm right there with you.
Okay,
I love
it. But that's all we've really managed before. I know my mother was watching the snowboarders.
What was interesting to me, ice dancing, is they have a broad view of what we call Latin music, which seems to include Sympathy from the Devil by the Rolling Stones. And I'm looking forward to more creative choices on the part of the music. But I did notice an article before the Olympics about athletes being named Olympic artists in residence, former Olympic athletes. And they name a few, and they're basically competitors of some years ago who now have taken up painting. And they're going to be honored or featured in some way by the Olympics. And you say, well, really, why would you do that? It's not like they're well-known painters. And the reason is that there is an Olympic tradition behind honoring artistic enterprise. And that is that between 1912 and 1948, the International Olympic Committee awarded gold, silver, and bronze medals to artists in five categories, namely painting, sculpture, architecture, literature, and music. In other words, people would go home with like a silver medal in literature in 1928.
Yeah, that's all very bizarre.
It is totally bizarre. And for obvious reasons, they kind of stopped doing that. They kind of lost enthusiasm for that.
But it's nice to know that art could be an Olympic sport or has been an Olympic sport.
Yes. But when we think about things that are bizarre that have persisted in the Olympics, there's curling.
There's curling.
And people are unabashed in their enthusiasm for curling.
We know some curling people. Curlers, are they called curlers? That doesn't seem possible, but I don't know what you call them.
I think they're called the people who are interested in curling.
Okay.
I think that's the phrase.
Yes.
And there was an article in the Times about a new high-tech curling broom. And
so is this by the same guy who did the Instant Pot, or
No. The Instant Pot is
a much bigger
success, and the Dyson guy can only improve on this. But what's interesting about this is that what you might say, what does it do? And what it does is it measures instantly how fast the broom is being swept and the pressure that's being applied by the broom. It's just measuring that, so that the competitors can learn from their experience as to what's effective, what's not effective. They'll do some sweeping and they'll say, oh, that had this effect. Then they'll check, oh, I was sweeping at X RPMs and I was sweeping at this
pressure. So it doesn't sweep better, it just collects data?
It refines your technique. It was invented by a guy who actually was working on the invention of a suit which was water cooled so you could wear it during the summer.
Okay.
And he put that aside.
But we have that already. When you sweat, it kind of water cools your suit.
This is in a suit. In any event. He got rid of, he stopped working on the climate controlled water cooled suit jacket, and he put all his efforts into this, which
call
he says
a seersucker.
He says this has been much more successful for him.
Okay, and but it's really just it's allowing you to refine your technique. It's not refining your.
It
technique.
Measures what you're doing. You're right. It refines your technique.
It gives you an opportunity to refine.
There were a couple of obituaries this week. One is a fellow named John Huntsman. And it was just kind of an amazing story. He was a fellow with a dirt poor background who grew up in California. And he managed to do extremely well in school. He was in Palo Alto in school. And he won a scholarship to Wharton. And frankly, it wouldn't be that interesting an obituary or a story. It was just a matter of, well, he got a degree, notwithstanding his poor background, and he stuck to it and became the head of a particular accounting firm. That's not it. He had all these entrepreneurial efforts, and that's what made him so interesting. So notwithstanding...
Well, not unlike a lot of kids. Once he graduates from college, and I guess gets out of the Navy or something.
Right, 2 years in
the Navy. He gets a job in his uncle's business.
Well, no, before that.
Before that?
You skipped a step.
I skipped a
step. Before he's doing that, he's working in a normal office, but he has his side hustle selling these records. He's packaging holiday records, right? And he's putting together packages of Nat King Cole's Christmas songs and the like and selling them. I almost said selling them online. Of course, there was no such thing as selling them online. But he made $1 million doing this. And then he gets married to a woman whose family is in the egg business. And in the egg business, they're telling him what they need is something that's going to carry the eggs better. And they're looking for a polystyrene container. And he helps develop that.
Yeah, he's put in charge of getting that developed.
Right, and here's
and
a guy...
Once he does that...
Here's a guy, by the way, who dropped chemistry in college because he said it would never be useful for him. And I guess he's worked with chemists.
You never know.
So they developed that, and then he realizes, or somebody realizes, you know what would be good? It would be good when people sold hamburgers at McDonald's or places like that if they put them in a container that closed up and kept them warm, and then you have the invention of the famous clamshell container.
Because it has insulating properties.
Right. And McDonald's passes first.
Right. He tries to sell it to McDonald's. They say, we don't think so.
Burger King buys.
And then McDonald's wants it. Can't live without it.
And how many millions of clamshells do you think he sells? Which is not great news for the environment. So they'll be taking down his statue sometime in the future.
But he sells that company, container company,
right,
for millions of bucks.
So he's a zillionaire.
And he's a zillionaire. And he actually goes off to do some... volunteer work. And while he's volunteering, he's planning the next move, which turns out to be by putting together chemical companies.
Right.
Cast-off chemical companies.
But he's a serial
from
entrepreneur.
A variety of giants.
So he's a fascinating guy. And there happened to be an article in the journal called Older Entrepreneurs Do It Better. And they said, you know, there's an odd fascination with the narrative that you have a very young kid coming out of college or skipping college and starting a company as an entrepreneur. But those are not the best suited individuals to be entrepreneurs. The best suited entrepreneurs or people who have experience in business, who might even be older, because number one, there's no better business school than being in business for a number of years. Number two, they might even be able to use products they've seen developed by the company they've been working with. And number three, they have the financial wherewithal, and they may be able to deal with it a little better or deal with the idea of not making money in a regular salary a little better. And they give numbers that demonstrate that older and experienced entrepreneurs are more successful than younger entrepreneurs, which is something that you see from this fellow, John Huntsman.
Right.
So all that's very logical.
Right.
Yeah.
So there you have it. And then just wanted to mention a local obituary, James Hamilton, Jim Hamilton of Lambertville. And he was an interesting guy, born in 1931. And he was a set designer who created all kinds of, sets, windows, showrooms. He decorated for the launch of the Ford Mustang at the 1964 World's Fair.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw his work in that situation. All of this, he was born in Lambertville, and had this business, this design business in Lambertville, where he created scenery for many Broadway shows, including Hair, Jesus Christ Superstar, Equus, also sets for various rock shows, David Bowie, Tina Turner, Rolling Stones, and he ends up designing restaurants in the area. And his restaurants were are beautiful.
Yeah, they're all over the place.
There's nothing more charming than the Swan Bar.
Right.
In Lambertville, all kinds of old antiques and a fireplace and really compelling. And the adorable boathouse next to the restaurant that Jim Hamilton had,
right.
Hamilton's Grill,
right.
Which really evokes a kind of sense of Italy. It's like you're there. It's very spare, very open. There's a grill in the middle of the restaurant.
Where we're going tonight. We're going to the Boathouse, and we're going to Hamilton's Grill.
Yeah, we're dying to do that. He's also the father of Gabrielle Hamilton, who is the owner of Prune in Manhattan, and the writer we always refer to in the New York Times, who writes great columns about food and gives out recipes. And I should say that Hamilton's Grill was opened by Hamilton with his daughter, Melissa, who still has a wonderful website, the Canal House, great recipes, etc. So he was a tireless sort of promoter and idea man, always contributed his efforts to local sort of charity and social efforts. He actually worked hard to design sort of commercial solutions for revitalizing Lambertville over the past 20 or 30 years. And he really was a force in the area. Let's see, there was a nice article here by local artist Robert Beck as a tribute to him, describing him as an advocate for the kind of progress and enterprise that worked for everybody. He backed it up with hard work. Jim understood community and believed there was an us. He gave so much. A pinch of flair, a dash of circus, every bit the ringmaster. So he was.
Okay. All right. So that sort of winds up the session. Tams and Dan read the paper, and we will leave you after our send-off with the one hit song that really was played during the encore's Hey, Look Me Over production on Thursday night. And that's a song that's called Once Upon a Time, which was a big hit and is performed, as you'll hear in a moment, by Tony Bennett.
And it's just interesting. It was in a musical by Mel Brooks.
The book,
the book by Mel Brooks.
So we're clear. Music by Charles Strauss. Lyrics by Lee Adams.
Called All American.
Right.
But who knew such a poignant, wonderful song would come out of that kind of play.
Yeah. So until next week, Tamton Dan, read the paper.
See you then.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. But that was once upon a time, very long ago. Once upon a time, we sat beneath a willow tree, counting all the stars and waiting for the dawn. But that was once upon a time. Now the tree is gone. How the breeze ruffled up her hair. How we always laughed as though tomorrow wasn't there. We Once upon a time, the world was sweeter than we knew. Everything was ours. How happy we were then. But somehow, once upon a time, never comes.